And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, this is May 17th, 137th day of the year. 228 days remain until the year is over with. On this day in history, in 1395 A.D., the Battle of Rovine, the Wallachians defeat an invading Ottoman army. 1521, Edward Stafford, third Duke of Buckingham, is executed for treason. 1527, Pánfilo de Narváez departs Spain to explore Florida, takes 600 men. By 1536, just four of those 600 are surviving. 1536, George Boleyn, second Viscount Rochford, and four of the men are executed for treason. Also in 1536, Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn's marriage is annulled. You didn't do what the king wanted, you're going to get your head cut off. 1590, Anne of Denmark is crowned King of Scotland. 1642, Paul de Chamadey, Sieur de Maisonneuve, founds the Villa Marie de Montreal. 1648, Emperor Ferdinand III defeats Maximilian I of Bavaria in the Battle of Zusmarhuschen. 1673, Louis Joliet and Jacques Marquette begin exploring the Mississippi River. 1756, 7 Years' War formally begins when Great Britain declares war on France. 1792, the New York Stock Exchange is formed under the Buttonwood Agreement. 1805, Muhammad Ali becomes Wali of Egypt. 1809, Emperor Napoleon I orders the annexation of the Papal States to the French Empire. See, the Pope and the area he had under his control was a separate country. 1814, occupation of Monaco changes from French to Austrian. Also in 1814, the Constitution of Norway is signed, and Crown Prince Christian Frederick of Denmark is elected King of Norway by the Norwegian Constituent Assembly. 1859, members of the Melbourne Football Club codified the first rules of Australian rules football. 1863, Rosalia de Castro publishes Cantares Gallegos, the first book in the Galician language. 1865, International Telegraph Union, later International Telecommunications Union, is established in Paris. 1875, Aristides wins the first Kentucky Derby with the jockey Oliver Lewis. Did it in 2 minutes, 37.75 seconds. 1883, Buffalo Bill's first Buffalo Bill's Wild West opens in Omaha, Nebraska. 1900, the Second Boer War. British troops relieve Mafeking. And also in 1900, the children's novel The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum is first published in the U.S. First copy goes to the author's sister. 1902, Greek archaeologist Valerio Stasis discovers the Antikythera mechanism, an ancient mechanical analog computer. 1914, the Protocol of Corfu was signed, recognized the full autonomy to Northern Epirus under the nominal Albanian sovereignty. 1915, the last British Liberal Party government led by H.H. Asquith falls. 1933, Vidkun Quisling and Johann Bernhard Hart form a National Samling, the National Socialist Party of Norway. The name Quisling became synonymous with traitor. 1937, Spanish Civil War. The Largo Caballero government resigns in the wake of the Barcelona May Days, leading Juan Negrin to form a government without the anarcho-socialist syndicalist CNT in its stead. 1939, the Columbia Lions and the Princeton Tigers play in the U.S. first televised sporting event, a collegiate baseball game in New York City. 1940, World War II, Germany occupies Brussels and Belgium. 1943, World War II, dam buster raids commence by No. 617 Squadron of the Royal Air Force. 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court hands down a unanimous decision in Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, outlawing racial segregation in public schools. 1967, Six-Day War. President Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt demands dismantling of the peacekeeping U.N. emergency force in Egypt. 1969, Venera Program. Soviet Venera 6 begins its descent into the atmosphere of Venus, sending back atmospheric data before being crushed by pressure. 1673, Watergate scandal. Televised hearings began in the U.S. Senate. 1974, the Troubles. 33 civilians are killed and 300 injured when the Ulster Volunteer Force detonates 4 car bombs in Dublin and Monaghan, Republic of Ireland. 1974, police in Los Angeles raid the Symbionese Liberation Army's headquarters. They kill 6 members, including Camilla Hall. 1977, Nolan Bushnell opens the first Showbiz Pizza Place, later renamed Chuck E. Cheese, in San Jose, California. 1980, General Chun Doo-hwan of South Korea seizes control of the government and declares martial law to suppress student demonstrations. Also in 1980, on the eve of the presidential elections, Maoist guerrilla group Shining Path attacks a polling place in Chuxi, a town in Ayutthaya, starting the internal conflict in Peru. 1983, U.S. Department of Energy declassifies documents showing the world's largest mercury pollution event in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, ultimately found to be 4.2 million pounds in response to the Appalachian Observer's Freedom of Information Act request. Also in 1983, Lebanon, Israel, and the United States signed an agreement on Israel withdrawal from Lebanon. 1984, Prince Charles calls a proposed addition to the National Gallery in London a monstrous carbuncle in the face of a much-loved and elegant friend, sparking controversies on the proper role of the royal family in the course of modern architecture. 1987, Iran-Iraq War. An Iraqi Dassault Mirage F-1 fighter jet fires 2 missiles into the U.S. Navy warship USS Stark, killing 37 and injuring 21 of her crew. 1990, General Assembly of the World Health Organization eliminates homosexuality from the list of psychiatric diseases. 1992, 3 days of popular protest against the government of Prime Minister of Thailand, Jacinda Kyriakpyun, began in Bangkok, leading to a military crackdown and results in 52 officially confirmed deaths, hundreds of injuries, a lot of disappearances, more than 3,500 arrests. 1994, Malawi holds its first multi-party elections. 1995, Sean Nelson steals a M-80 tank from the California Army National Guard Army in San Diego and proceeds to go on a rampage. 1997, troops of Laurent Kabila march into Kinshasa, Zaire, is officially renamed Democratic Republic of Congo. 2000, Arsenal and Galatasaray fans clashed in the 2000 UEFA Cup final riots in Copenhagen. 2004, the first legal same-sex marriages in the U.S. performed in the state of Massachusetts. 2006, the aircraft carrier USS Oriskany is sunk in the Gulf of Mexico as an artificial reef. 2007, trains from North and South Korea cross the 30th parallel in a test run agreed to by both governments. First time that trains have crossed demilitarized zone since 1953. And in 2014, a plane crash in northern Laos killed 17 people. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Let's see what we got in the way of holidays and observances. Birthday of the Raja in Perlis, Christian Feast Day, Julia Salzano, Pasquale Bailon, William Hobart Hare in the Episcopal Church in the U.S., Restituta, Children's Day in Norway, Constitution Day in Nauru. Earliest day in which the Trinity Sunday can fall. June 20th is the latest, celebrated on the first Sunday after Pentecost in Western Christianity. Feast of Azamat and the Bahia Faith. Galatian Literature Day in Galatia. International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia, and Biphobia. Liberation Day in Democratic Republic of the Congo. National Day Against Homophobia in Canada, Navy Day in Argentina, Norwegian Constitution Day, World Hypertension Day, and World Information Society Day internationally. Let's see what we got. Anything else, if there is anything else. Okay. In 218, it's the seventh recorded perihelion passage of Halley's Comet. 352, Liberius begins his reign as Catholic Pope, replacing Julius I. 884, St. Adrian III begins his reign as Catholic Pope. 1521, Edward Stafford was executed for treason. He was the third Duke of Buckingham. 1525, the battle at Zabern. The Duke of Lutherans beats rebels. Let's see. 1536, Anne Boleyn's four lovers executed shortly before her own beheading. 1544, Scott Earl Matthew Lennox signs a secret treaty with Henry VIII. 1579, Artois, Henegouin, and French Flanders sign a treaty, the Peace of Parma, recognizing Spanish Duke Van Parma as the land guardian. 1620, the first merry-go-round is seen at a fair in Philippopolis in Turkey. 1630, Italian Jesuit Niccolo Zucchi is the first to see two belts on Jupiter's surface. 1631, Earl Johann Tilly attacks Magdeburg. 1672, Frontenac becomes governor of New France. That was Canada. Let's see. 1712, Maximilian Emmanuel of Bavaria honored as the sovereign of the Netherlands. 1733, Great Britain passes the Molasses Act, putting high tariffs on rum and molasses imported to the colonies from a country other than a British possession. 1742, Battle of Chausseets. Prussia, led by Frederick the Great, defeats Austria. 1744, the French army takes Austria and Netherlands. 1750, the attacks revolt in Carinthian. 1775, during the American Revolutionary War, the Continental Congress bans trade with Canada. 1787, the English slave ship Sister, en route from Africa to Cuba, capsizes, kills hundreds. 1803, John Hawkins and Richard French patent a reaping machine. 1814, Denmark cedes Norway to Sweden. 1824, the diaries of Lord Byron are burned by six of his friends at the office of John Murray in London, been described as the greatest crime in literary history. 1848, Gerrit, Count Schimmelpenninck, resigns as chairman of the Council of Ministers in the Netherlands. 1849, fire destroys the Centrum in St. Louis, Missouri. 1861, the first color photograph of a tartan ribbon shown by Scottish scientist James Clerk Maxwell to the Royal Institution in London. 1862, the Battle of Princeton, West Virginia, ends with about 128 casualties. 1863, the Battle of Big Black River Bridge in Mississippi takes place. 1864, the Battle of Adairsville, Georgia. Union forces Confederates to retreat. 1871, Native American fighter General William T. Sherman escapes from the Comanches in an ambulance. 1872, the Bohemian Club is incorporated in San Francisco. 1876, the 7th U.S. Cavalry under General George Armstrong Custer leaves Fort Lincoln. That was their last trip, I think. 1881, Frederick Douglass was appointed Recorder of Deeds for Washington, D.C. 1881, on this date, they published a revised version of the New Testament. 1884, Alaska becomes a U.S. territory. It's known as Seward's Folly. 1890, Comic Cuts. The first weekly comic paper is published in London. 1897, the first successful submarine that can run submerged for any considerable distance and combines electric and gasoline engines is launched in the U.S. by its designer, John Philip Holland. It was known as the Holland Boat. 1898, Camp Merritt is formed in the Presidio in San Francisco. 1899, the Victoria and Albert Museum Foundation is laid in London. 1900, in China, three villages within 100 miles of Peking are burned by the Boxers and 60 Chinese Christians are killed. This was during what was known as the Boxer Rebellion. 1906, Switzerland's Simplon Tunnel, open to rail traffic. 1915, the National Baptist Convention is chartered on this date. 1919, the UK War Department orders the use of the National Star Insignia on all their airplanes. 1920, the first de Havilland double-decker flight lands in Schiphol, left London. 1921, President Warren G. Harding opens, via telephone, the first Valencia Art Show. 1926, Chiang Kai-shek on this date is made Supreme Warlord in Canton. 1927, Army aviation pioneer Major Harold Geiger dies in the crash of his Airco DH-4 de Havilland plane at Olmsted Field in Pennsylvania. 1938, the radio quiz show Information Please debuts on NBC Blue Network. 1942, the Dutch SS vows loyalty to Hitler. 1943, millionaire Howard Hughes crashes into Lake Mead while test flying his Sikorsky S-43. It killed a CAA inspector, Checo Klein, and Richard Felt. 1944, Chinese and U.S. Armed Forces take Itakina Airport in Burma. On this day in 1944, Eisenhower sets D-Day for June 5th. Also in 1944, Operation Straight Line, the Allies land in Dutch New Guinea. 1946, on this date, President Harry Truman seizes control of the nation's railways in order to delay a strike. 1948, Soviet Union recognizes Israel. 1957, there was the Prayer Pilgrimage, the biggest civil rights demonstration to that date. 1959, Sanctuary of Christ the King is inaugurated. That's a 28-meter or 92-foot tall high monument and shrine overlooking Lisbon, Portugal. Done by sculptor Francisco Franco de Sousa. 1960, the first atomic reactor system was patented by J.W. Flora of Canoga Park, California. 1961, Fidel Castro very magnanimously offered to exchange the Bay of Pigs prisoners for 500 bulldozers. 1970, Hank Aaron becomes the ninth player to get 3,000 hits. And I think that is pretty much it for our history segment. You know, we've been talking about a lot of strange things because this is a strange world, whether we want to admit it or not. Now, I talked a little bit about the fact that there are those that believe that UFOs are actually living creatures who live in the sky. And if the skies of our planet are constantly populated with an untold number of airborne critters, then why don't we see them for what they really are and on a regular basis? Now, there's one theory that they reflect infrared light, which is invisible to the naked human eye. However, there's also a belief that these creatures can change color, and that explains why they're occasionally seen and sometimes they're just there. It's not really a case of they're here 1 minute, gone the next. It's actually a case that we can see them 1 minute, the next we can't. According to a number of researchers, they're always here in massive numbers, we just can't see them. And this explains why some UFO witnesses have photographed UFOs but hadn't seen anything out of the ordinary when they took the pictures. Now, there's a man by the name of Trevor James Constable who came up with this theory. And he believes even though these sky creatures possess formidable powers that allow them to remain out of sight, they can be seen and photographed if you specifically use infrared film and a suitable filter. He went out to the Mojave Desert and put his theory into practice. And he said he had considerable success in California's Lucerne Valley. And he published his photos, which continue to provoke a great deal of debate among the UFO faithful. Now, in May of 1977, a UFO investigator named Richard Toronto, who had developed a fascination for Constable's theories, decided to try and replicate those photos. He went out to the Mojave Desert, and he claimed he had success. Now, as with Constable's pictures, which some researchers felt showed nothing stranger than aircraft landing lights, stars, and planets, there were anomalies photographed. Now, there's another theory for what both Trevor James Constable and Richard Toronto photographed, and it's a fascinating one. It's postulated by the late UFO and paranormal investigator D. Scott Rogo. It was his opinion, maybe we should say strong suspicion, that both men had unknowingly created the sky monsters from the depths of their imagination and their subconscious. And their psychic abilities allowed them to project their mind monsters externally to the point where they had quasi-independent lives are going to be caught on camera. We'll probably not know for quite some time. Now, turning from sky monsters, without a doubt, one of the strangest aspects of cryptozoology is its tie-in with the crop circle mystery. Now, it's a little-known aspect of both phenomena. There are more than a few accounts that exist of strange creatures seen in and around crop circles. From Matthew Williams, only British man ever arrested, charged, and convicted for making a crop circle, there are a number of stories that he threw out. Unsurprisingly, for somebody who spent years deeply immersed within the crop circle controversy, Matthew Williams is a veritable fountain of knowledge with respect to tales of weird creatures having been seen in or at least in the direct vicinity of crop circle formations. And one of those cases is quite strange. Now, according to this young man, the story in question concerned a man who had felt curiously compelled to drive late one night to a certain field in Wiltshire. This was a number of years ago. He got there, parked his car, and began his walk into the depths of the crop growing in the field. Suddenly, out of nowhere, a large black human-like figure appeared near over the field. Now, according to Mr. Williams, it reminded him a little bit of the Mothman sightings when he heard the story. He went on to say that the source of the story could only stand and stare in awe, while suddenly gaining the distinct impression that the hovering entity was the source of at least some of the crop circle formations that were appearing in Wiltshire. That precise moment, a single crop circle suddenly appeared on the ground immediately below this hovering black figure, after which it vanished from the skies, and the man was left utterly alone in the field with no real option other than to make his way back to his vehicle and go home. Now, certainly, he was baffled and bewildered by both the weird and aerial activity and what it was that had directed him to the field. Now, according to Matthew Williams, there was one time, I'd rather not say when or where exactly, as I could get into trouble for admitting, I trespassed on the farmer's land and made the crop circle formation. He said, I had a friend named Paul helping me with this one. We were making this circle, and he noticed three bright lights, small balls of light, coming toward the field. And they stood and watched, and of course they were fascinated by what they were seeing. And then these balls of light split up, and each of them went to a corner of the field, and which only left one corner for us to leave by without getting too close to these things. And he admitted that what they saw was a bit unsettling. We didn't know what these balls were, so we raced out of the open corner of the field. And as they ran, they looked back to see the balls heading toward them, gliding very gracefully just above the top of the crop, like they were on a railway track, just moving very smoothly, but it left them sort of disturbed as well. They seemed to be alive, and he described them as ghostly. Now, the story wasn't over. When Matthew Williams got to the car and told Paul to wait in the bushes at the edge of the road so he couldn't be seen, last thing he wanted was for him to get arrested if the police happened to drive by. But by the time he had gotten to the car and got back to Paul, he was walking up the middle of the road with all his crop circle equipment in full view. He said he pulled up and put the window down, shouted, what the hell are you doing? If people see you carrying your equipment, we'll get arrested. He said Paul looked scared stiff and said, if that arrested me, I'd have gone with him just to get out of here. Asked him what he meant, and he said, well, Williams was getting in the car, he heard these strange animal-like screaming noises coming from inside the field, and he just ran out of the bushes and onto the road. They never did find out what caused the sounds or what those balls of light were. Now, Matthew Williams wasn't alone in commenting on such matters. In the summer of 2007, Marcus Matthews, a researcher of mysterious big cats in Britain, admitted he was then currently investigating a case involving a person who had seen a huge black cat sitting inside the confines of a Wiltshire crop circle. So, how do you define and explain these reports? Well, the answer right now is we can't. But if you ever find yourself deep in the heart of a huge crop circle, keep an eye out for what may be around you. We never know. Well, from crop circles in England, let's talk about what happened in West Virginia town of Flatwoods. It was the night of September 12, 1952, and something terrifying descended on that small town. Precisely what it was remains a mystery to this day. All that could be said is that it was hideous, fear-inducing, and downright monstrous, and it's become known as the Flatwoods Monster. Now, Flatwoods is situated in Braxton County and dominated by a mountainous, forested landscape. That's a distinctly small town. That much is apparent from the fact that today its population is less than 400. Back in 1952, it was even less than that. On a night in question, though, the town found its population briefly added to by one visitor from, well, someplace. Nobody really knows where. It all began as the sun was setting on what was a warm, still September evening. A group of boys from the town were playing football in the town schoolyard when they were frozen to the spot by the sight of a brightly lit, fiery object that shot overhead. And certainly it provoked amazement and wonder as it passed by. All the boys could be sure of was that the object appeared to be either egg-shaped or circular, and its color fluctuated from orange to fiery red. As they stood and watched in awe, they saw the object begin to descend, at a high rate of speed, no less, and then appear to come down on one of Flatwood's largest hilltops. Well, not surprisingly, being young men of a certain age, they saw this as a big adventure. The result? They, with a woman named Kathleen May and a recent U.S. Army recruit named Eugene Lemon, headed off for the scene of what they thought was all the action. It wasn't long before the group got to the hill in question, and when they got there, nightfall was rapidly closing in. First thing they noticed as they reached that darkened peak was something brightly lit within the trees. Now, what it was, nobody had a clue, but it clearly wasn't the lights of a farmhouse, a truck, or a car. And suddenly the air was filled with a sickening odor, not unlike that of devilish brimstone. And, of course, this was not a good sign. To their credit, though, they pushed on, determined to figure out the true nature of the source behind the lights. And they quickly found out, as the air became filled with a strange sizzling sound. Nothing less than a pair of self-illuminated red eyes could be seen getting even closer to them. Now, Kathleen May had the presence of mind to bring a flashlight with her, and she focused it on the eyes. And in doing so, she lit up the abominable creature that possessed those eyes. Looming before the now hysterical band of intrepid people was an approximately 10-foot-tall floating monster. It appeared to be humanoid in shape and had a large black cowling behind its head. It gave the entire head a kind of Ace of Spades appearance, and it was possibly even cloaked. Oddly, its lower half was ice cream cone shaped and had wires and cables running from it. The issue of the cone-shaped lower portion led flying saucer investigators to later suggest the monster may have been encased within some kind of remotely piloted vehicle. As the creature then turned its attention to the group and wildly fired laser-like beams from its eyes, this intrepid band of investigators quickly lost their nerve. They didn't wait to see what was going to happen next. One and all, they turned and ran, except for the Miss May brassly shouted to the boys to follow her home, which they all did. When they got there, and possibly the result of exposure to the noxious odor that hung around the hill, several of the boys became violently ill. They felt nauseated, even started vomiting. Kathleen May quickly and shakily called the local police, who rather intriguingly were busy responding to reports of what was described as an airplane crash in the area. Turns out there was no crashed airplane ever found. Something that suggests the airplane and the brightly lit UFO that descended on the hilltop were perhaps one and the same. And as a result of the fact that Flatwoods was and still is a very small town, word soon got out that about what had happened. Local media were quickly on the scene, and even U.S. Air Force sat up and took notice. Despite intense investigations by the press and the military, the mystery of the Flatwoods monster was never solved. The creature was long gone by the time anybody else got to the scene. But it is decidedly interesting to note that Flatwoods is only about 125 miles from the town of Point Pleasant, West Virginia, where from 1966 to 1967, another red-eyed monster by the name of Mothman was making the rounds. Well, from Flatwoods, let's go to Kelly. It was, and still is, a small rural town situated just short of 10 miles from Hopkinsville. They're the kind of places where people keep to themselves. Nothing of a particularly sensational matter ever happens. The part that is from that fateful night of August 21st, 1955, when the absolute chaos broke out. It all started at the farmhouse of the Sutton family. They had visitors in from Pennsylvania, don't you know? Billy Ray Taylor and his wife. Roughly 7 p.m. when Billy Ray left the farmhouse to get water from the family's well. And that was something of a mistake, it turned out. In minutes, Billy Ray was back, minus the water. He was terrified, and he told the Suttons and his wife that he headed toward the well. He saw a significantly sized, illuminated, circular-shaped object come to rest on a nearby gully. Now, the people tried to figure out what on earth was going on, and they mused about the possibility of shooting stars and meteorites and even a good old-fashioned leg-pulling. But by all accounts, it was none of these. In a few minutes, the Suttons' dog began to bark and growl and snarl in aggressive, uncontrollable fashion, and after which it took out for cover underneath the porch. And, of course, Billy Ray thought about joining the dog, but he didn't. Clearly, something strange was going on. But exactly how strange soon became very apparent. Now, intent on making sure they were in control of the situation, Elmer and Lucky Sutton and Billy Ray Taylor armed themselves with shotguns and headed out into the darkness. In no time, they were confronted by something terrifying, a small silvery creature about 3 feet tall that was scurrying toward them with its long ape-like arms held high in the air. Well, Sutton did what most folks might do when confronted by a strange goblin-like creature after sunset. He opened up on it with his shotgun. Well, to the consternation of both men, the shotgun didn't have any effect aside from causing the creature to do a quick, impressive backflip, after which it disappeared into the darkness, at least for a while. Rather wisely, Elmer and Billy Ray ran back to the safety of the farmhouse and locked the doors. Left that poor dog under the porch, don't you know? In mere moments, that same creature, at least a very similar one, was seen peering and leering at him through the windows. Elmer's son, J.C., who had his own gun, took a shot at it. Only thing that got damaged was the window. But the small creature scurried away at lightning speed. And in Lucky Sutton, along with Billy Ray, took a tentative walk outside to see if they could see the creature or creatures. Well, that was not exactly a brilliant move, because as they wandered around the property, a clawed hand came down from the roof and grabbed Billy Ray's hair and pulled. Well, terrified, Billy Ray pulled away, screaming, and looked up to see the goblin charge across the roof. And to their shock and dismay, a second creature was seen staring at him from the branches of a nearby tree. Well, as you might guess, a second shootout took place, which achieved nothing aside from the remarkably weird sight of the creatures floating, rather than leaping or falling to the ground and racing off into the darkness. Well, these events continued throughout the night, with guns blazing and the wizened little beasts seemingly doing their best to create as much havoc and mayhem as conceivably possible. Realizing this situation might very well go on all night, the group decided there was only one option available to them. They had to get the heck out of Dodge, which they did in two cars. They made their way to the sheriff's office in Hopkinsville. The sheer collective state of fear into which the Suttons and the Taylors had been plunged pretty much immediately convinced the sheriff that whatever was going on, it was not a prank. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, depending on your point of view, by the time the sheriff and the family got back to the farmhouse, the creatures were gone. They did, though, put in a reappearance in the early hours, and conveniently after the police had left. No time at all, the media got onto the story, as did the U.S. Air Force. The Air Force came up with a very bizarre explanation as its staff sought to calm matters. Now, it's important to have a full understanding of the physical appearance of these creatures, which came from the memories and recollections of the folks involved, the Suttons and the Taylors. All these strange entities were nearly identical: long arms, skinny legs, large ears, and yellow eyes. And as for their gait, they moved in a strange pivoting fashion. They were also silver in color. Well, that led to the Air Force best guess of what really happened. With absolutely nothing solid at all to back up its claims, the Air Force suggested the goblins are actually monkeys that had been painted silver and escaped from a traveling circus. Now, that's usually the solution arrived at by ivory tower scientists who don't see it themselves, but firmly believe that they can't be wrong because, after all, they're ivory tower scientists. According to cryptozoologist Ken Gerhardt, it's a theory more ridiculous than a notion of invading aliens. I mean, after all, who would paint a monkey silver? And why would any self-respecting monkey attack a farmhouse in the middle of nowhere? Nevertheless, the Air Force stuck to its guns, Major John Albert being the major proponent of the circus escapee painted monkey theory. Now, ufologists, of course, didn't just accept that theory without question. One of the most respected of all UFO researchers, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, said of his investigation that Air Force claims, I did make an attempt to find out whether there had been a traveling circus in the area from which the monkeys could have escaped. The monkey hypothesis fails, though, if the basic testimony of the witness can be accepted. Under a barrage of gunfire from the Kentuckians over a somewhat extended period, it's unthinkable that at least one cadaver wouldn't have been found. And monkeys do not float down from trees. They either jump or fall. But at the end of the day, Mr. Hynek could not find any trace of a traveling circus or any silver-painted monkeys. The 1955 Kelly Hopkinsville saga remains unresolved to this date. The fact that the incident began with the sightings of what may well have been a UFO has led to flying saucer sleuths to conclude a mini-alien invasion briefly broke out in rural Kentucky. On the other hand, is it possible the Air Force was at least partly on the right track? Could the creatures have been monkeys after all? Or did they just simply make a monkey out of the Air Force? Yeah. You pays your nickel, you takes your chance. Well, from the wilds of Kentucky, let's go to Scotland. Everybody's familiar with Nessie, but you know there are other monsters said to come from Loch Ness. In 1968, Alistair Baxter, who had a lifelong interest in stories and folklore relative to Irish and Scottish lake monsters, went to Loch Ness and spent 9 weeks armed with a camera and binoculars, quietly and carefully monitoring the loch for any unusual activity of the long-necked hump variety. Now, he never did see the elusive beast of Loch Ness, but he was able to speak with numerous people who had seen it. And after his time spent at Lochside almost constantly for 5 weeks, an unusual event occurred. He was awoken in the middle of the night by a curious humming sound that was emanating from a bright, small ball of light about the size of a football that, at the height of about 15 feet, was slowly and carefully making its way through the trees that enveloped Baxter's modestly sized tent. Now, suddenly, without warning, a ball of light shot into the sky at a height of several hundred feet and hovered in deathly silence over the still waters of Loch Ness. And for reasons that Baxter was at a loss to explain, he felt an overwhelming urge to go back to sleep. Next thing he knew, it was daybreak. But the strangeness was not over yet. Shortly after breakfast, three men in black suits appeared outside of his tent, seemingly coming out of nowhere, and proceeded to ask him if he'd seen anything unusual during the night. Now, he said he hadn't, at which point one of the three turned to his two colleagues and made what Baxter said was a strange smile. Then he turned to face Baxter and said, we might return. And then all three simply walked off into the woods. They never did come back. And one of them was not Tommy Lee Jones, in case you're wondering, was it the Men in Black? Most interesting of all, and of deep relevance to the overall story, for the following 3 nights he had a recurring and frightening dream of a large, lumbering ape man who would pace outside his tent and head down to the shores of the loch, whereupon under a starlit sky would tilt its head back, wail loudly, and stand staring at the ink-black water. And the dream would always end the same way, with an image of a huge, monstrous atomic mushroom cloud exploding in the distance, and the beginning of the Third World War and the end of civilization as we know it. Well, Baxter's stories made more thought-provoking for one very interesting reason. There are a lot of accounts that have come to light from people who believe that they've undergone some form of alien abduction, who they maintain have been shown the images by the aliens of a desolate, irradiated Earth of the near future been ravaged by a worldwide nuclear war. This is a warning of what will happen if we don't change our ways, according to one of the abductees. Interestingly, she talked about a frightening and futuristic scene that she believed showed a ruined and permanently cloud-covered sky of London, where the starving survivors were forced to do battle for food with strange, hairy ape men who would surface at night out of the rubble and remains of the flattened London Underground Railway system. So how do we explain such undeniably rogue events like those of Alistair Baxter and other witnesses. Right now, we can't. All we can say is that they offer further food for thought that the British Bigfoot isn't all that it initially appears to be. Maybe until we know more, it's apposite and wise to place such hard-to-define cases in our definitive gray basket and leave them there until we have more information. Well, beyond any shadow of a doubt, one of the most bizarre of all encounters with the strange and unknown occurred in Jumenda, Estonia, in the late 1930s. According to an investigation undertaken by UFO expert Dr. Jacques Vallée, two witnesses encountered a small, about 3 feet tall, humanoid creature with brown-green skin and distinct frog-like characteristics. Its eyes were slit-like, as was its mouth. It appeared not to be all accustomed to walking on land. Its awkward gait made that abundantly clear, and particularly so when it caught sight of individuals and that were watching it and made good its escape. And while it did outrun its pursuers, it did so in a very odd, near drunken-like state. Similar state of affairs occurred in the heart of the woodland of Oakland Park, of Orland Park, Illinois, September 24, 1951. The man who witnessed something remarkable and disturbing was a steelworker named Harrison Bailey. And as he walked through the park, he was suddenly plagued by a burning sensation to his neck that was accompanied by a sense of cramp in his neck as well. Sensing he was being watched, he swung around and found himself confronted by a gray-colored object of a large size that was described as being whirlwind-like in shape. Well, at that point, things became, decidedly weird. He felt groggy, confused, and almost in a dreamlike state. And then he knew nothing. His next memory was vague, but revolved around being surrounded by a large group of 18-inch-high humanoids that resembled frogs. They asked bizarre questions such as where he was from and where he was going. All he could focus on was the fact that he felt somewhat paralyzed and unable to move properly. Well, he said that unsettling feeling wore off soon, and he was left to make his stumbling slightly out of it way back home. Now, despite having come out of the odd encounter unscathed, he had a nagging feeling there was more to be experienced than he could consciously recall. Finally, he elected to do something about it and underwent regressive hypnosis, and that proved to be beneficial, although while he was pleased and relieved by what he learned after being placed in an altered state of mind is another matter entirely. In his hypnotic state, he found himself back in the park, surrounded by these odd, diminutive things. And he was able to build a much clearer picture of what they looked like. The frogmen had slits for mouths, large staring eyes, stripy black brown skin, and just 3 toes. And all around the creatures were dozens of smaller bug-like things that would wildly race around the woodland floor. They then followed an amazing situation in which he found himself in telepathic conversation with the frogmen, who informed him that humankind's warlike ways would be its downfall, and they wanted Bailey to spread the warning. He found himself back in the woods and on the path back home. In many respects, his encounter sounds like a classic example of what's been infamously come known as the alien abduction, except for one thing. The creatures he met with sound far more cryptozoological in nature than they do anything related to UFOs. Now, from there, we go to the experiences of Karen Totten, an artist and sculptor who had a wealth of anomalous experiences throughout her life, one of which was with an entity that falls definitively into the woman in black category. Yes, the men in black have their female counterparts. She said when she was 17, she was working in a small convenience store when a woman came in to buy cigarettes. She said at first I didn't pay any attention to her until I saw her hand when she handed me the money, and it was not a normal human hand. It startled her, so she looked up and saw a very pale entity wearing a thin black coat with the collar turned up to cover her neck, a long, heavy-haired wig, and very large, dark glasses. Now, even these large, dark glasses didn't entirely hide her strange face. She had a pointed chin, scant lip and nose, and she didn't speak. Took her cigarettes and left. Totten was left kind of stunned, and oddly enough, she couldn't remember the details of her hand, although it was the first thing she did notice. You know, did she think that the woman left in the car, since it was odd, most patrons drove up to the store, it was somewhat isolated. She said, "When the entity is, whether the entity is a gray or a hybrid, I can only guess. I've never seen what is described as a classic gray alien. Maybe hybrid is more fitting simply because there seemed to be some variety of attributes associated with the general category. They didn't fit perfectly with the classic gray alien, the size of the head being the main thing. Some details she does recall with some clarity. The skin, it was very pale, white almost with a bluish-gray tint to it, and of an unusually smooth texture. She'd never seen anything like it before or since, and she'd previously seen an albino. It was nothing like that. Her skin was not unpigmented, though there was an almost translucent quality to it. And there were a few other anomalies as well, such as her facial features. Though she didn't see her eyes due to the large Jackie L-style sunglasses she wore, other aspects were evident. Unusually long, pointy chin. Exaggerated cheekbones out of proportion to the rest of the face. Almost no lips, only enough to discern that there was a mouth. A nose that was almost not there. Very little structure to it, and a small bridge area, and some structure around the nostrils, but not much. And finally, there was her neck. Though the coat collar was turned up, she could see some of the neck, which was oddly thin. The wig, it was obviously a wig, a long, thick, dishwater blonde mane of a cheap imitation hair that probably came from Kmart, seemed placed to hide other features of the head. Because of that, she couldn't comment on the ears or the actual shape of the head. It puzzles her why she couldn't recall the hand, though. Maybe that's because it was what startled her the most. Only thing she could relate this to, this lack of recall, is a nasty car accident she had years later. After which she completely blacked out the memory, the worst part of the accident, the part where, when it was occurring. And she asked her doctor about it and was told it was not uncommon for the human brain to forget traumatic or difficult events. She could only surmise the initial part of the encounter with the cigarette lady was traumatic in some fashion. There were no other people in the store. She was alone. It was afternoon. It was 1974, maybe 75. She worked both summers between high school and college and between her first and second years of college. But she was pretty sure it was probably 74, and the location was an area south of St. Louis, Missouri. She said she didn't have any lingering psychological effect from this encounter that she was aware of, other than extreme puzzlement and that blocked memory of her hand. As for whether this changed her in some fashion, she wasn't sure, but certainly it well could have. You know, the fascinating thing about a lot of these stories is that those who have these encounters are far more shocked than, frankly, they ought to be. Which makes you wonder how that could happen. You know, consider, if you will, an account from a man named Ralph, a monk and an abbot of Cogshall in Essex, England. This was back in the year 1200, and he wrote about it in Chronicon Anglican. Story describes a remarkable capture in the area of nothing less than a definitive wild man of the woods creature. So there are, or were, other creatures out there than besides humans. It happened during the time of King Henry II when Bartholomew de Glanville was in charge of the castle of Orford. And what happened was that some fishermen fishing in the sea caught in their nets what they called a wild man. He was naked, like a man in all his members, covered with hair with a long shaggy beard. And he ate whatever was given to him, but if it was raw, he pressed it between his hands till all the juice was out of it. He wouldn't talk, even when tortured and hung up by his feet. He was brought into the church and showed no sign of reverence or belief. He went to bed at sunset, remained there till sunrise. And he was allowed to go into the sea, strongly guarded by three lines of nets. But he dove under the nets and came up again and again. Eventually, he came back of his own free will, even though later on he escaped, was never seen again. Or maybe the beast man, if that's what it was seen again, although hundreds of years further down the line. This was in 1968. Individual named Morris Allen grew up in the vicinity of Orford, was walking along the coast. Near, of all places, the town of Orford itself, when in the distance he saw someone squatting in the sand, leaning over something. As he got closer, Morris said, he could see the man was dressed in what looked like an animal skin, was savagely tearing into the flesh of a dead rabbit. He was dirty and crusted with long tangled hair and had wild, staring eyes. Morris could only watch with a mixture of fascination and horror. Suddenly, the wild man held his head up and looked, or maybe glared, in Morris's direction as if he'd picked up his scent. Scooped up the rabbit and bounded off into the grass, was ever forever lost from sight. Maybe the wild man of Orford and its surrounding area continues to live on, taunting and tantalizing people with the occasional sightings of its bestial form. But it does raise an interesting question. Does there exist with us, or coexist with us, other races on this planet? Some who do not look anywhere near human. Certainly that could well be the explain a lot of the sightings that have taken place. You know, Bernard Heuvelmans, one of the most important figures in the field of cryptozoology, said during the course of his research into the Yeti of the Himalayas, he'd learned of no fewer than three distinct kinds of creatures that roam that vast mountain. He said this opinion was confirmed in 1957 by a Tibetan Lama named Punyabhayara, high priest of the monastery at Budnath. Spent 4 months in the high mountains and brought back the surprising but valuable information that the Tibetan mountain people knew three kinds of snowmen. There was the Rima, a man-beast of close to 3 meters in height that dwelled in the Barun Kola Valley in eastern Nepal and was specifically omnivorous. Then there was a Rakshi Bumpo, beast of roughly human proportions, which Heuvelmans said must be the Serpa's reddish yeti, or maite, with leaves of footprints 20 to 23 centimeters long that the Daily Mail talks about. And then there's the imposing and terrifying Nyamo. Now, the Nyamo are real giants between 4 and 5 meters high, with enormous conical heads. They wander in parties along the eternal snows above 4,000 meters. In such arid country, it's hardly surprising to be carnivorous and even man-eating. Now, Heuvelmans asked the Nyamo, do they really exist or are they just a myth? Now, he admitted he'd heard of accounts of yetis with feet around 45 to 60 meters in length, but was carefully to qualify this by stating the evidence is far too slender for us to draw any satisfactory conclusions. Maybe the Nyamo was an invented addition based on the belief that the Yetis increase in size the higher you go. Okay, as usual, everybody and their brother tries to call me when I'm on the air. Well, when Edmund Hillary was on the Himalayas looking for Yeti, he and his collaborator, journalist Desmond Doig, noted there were several unknown primates had to still be undiscovered in any formal way. You know, they didn't discover the gorilla for quite some time. It was looked at as a myth and a legend. Among the varieties was one called the Nyamo, and Hillary and Doig learned of the Nyamo in north central Nepal. Was said to be a creature up to 20 feet tall, man-like, hairy, and given to shaking giant pine trees and trials of drink, while the Nyamo sit around and clap their hands. Sounds interesting. Well, on that note, we've come to the end of today's show. We've run out of time. So, once again, we'll be back tomorrow and talk more about the strange and the unusual. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.